Good afternoon. Starting the various recording devices. And welcome to a year of Eov, of Job. I apologize for doing this standing up, which is awkward, and I will probably sway a little bit. I prefer to do this sitting down. But as a result of a back injury last week, I am not able to sit down for an hour. So I'm going to be doing this standing up instead. But it is improving, and God willing, by next week, I will be back to normal. Please do make sure that Joyce has your email address there, because I like to send out the source sheets by email in advance. Questions that come up during class, I may follow up on by email afterwards. Also, I upload audio from the class each week to website yutorah.org, Yeshiva University's website, for audio recordings of classes. And this way, I can always send you the link to the audio. And if you miss a week, you can catch up that way. You also see the camera here. This is from a website called koshertube.com. And they upload the video of the class as well. I think the audio is much more attractive, but that's just me. As I said in the email that I sent out last week to people who I hoped were coming to the class, you'll need a Tanakh for the class. The synagogue does have some Tanakhs available. There are a couple of them over there, and that's fine to use. Which edition of the Tanakh is not really that significant for it as much as making sure that you have one. I do bring sources on the source sheets, but when it comes to the verses, I'd like to be able to just refer to the Tanakh and work from there. I will also ask at this point, and let it go for the year, please, if people could make sure that their cell phones are on silent or vibrate or whatever it is, that would be very helpful. So we ended up with this topic. Oh, before I forget, one other introduction. I am Mordechai Torchiner. Sorry, I should say that at some point. Okay, great. Thank you. I am with the Yeshiva University Torah Mitzion Beit Midrash Zichron Adov. We are now in our sixth year. It is a study program for rabbinical students at Yeshivat Or Chaim, the boys' high school up on the corner of Almore and Faywood. But it's also an educational resource for the community, and in particular, we have four main areas in which our programming tries to serve the community. One, we work a lot with high school and university students. Second is that we provide education and professional education, in particular, for professionals, doctors, lawyers, business people. We try to provide advanced Torah education opportunities for women, and we provide Israel-oriented programming. Those are our main four foci, no? I think it is. Okay. No one else knows, then it doesn't matter. This year, we're learning Eov, we're learning Job, and this was a topic that was given to me by popular request. And so I wanted to turn the question to you and ask you, why in the world would you want to learn the book of Job? What is it about Job that people are, and they know they are, because I've heard this for years and I've just been ducking the topic. But why is it that people want to learn the book of Job?
Good and evil.
Good and evil.
I mean, that's huge. Not that one book of the Bible can cover that, but... That's one of the basic questions that people have.
Well, good and evil? Or what would you see?
Good problem.
Right. Good and evil or good and suffering?
Well, okay.
Because we, one question that will come up throughout the book is Job good? So that's sort of part of it.
Good or evil.
Good or evil. Okay.
So then why just good things happen? Bad things happen to good people.
Right.
That's one of the reasons I'm interested.
Bad things and good people. Sharon?
But it's similar. Life is all about good people or someone who could be good suffering a lot. We're all interested in why we have to suffer. And that's when we understand Job's suffering, we can understand our own.
Right. So through Job to understand our own experiences. Okay. Jeez.
For me, it's about... learning how to handle the times of stress and keeping your faith. Because all the greats, not just everybody, but all the great, I mean, Moshe, everybody suffered. Aaron, everybody suffered. How do you keep going after that? How do you keep the strength to continue to believe? And how do you keep relating to the Almighty in circumstances?
Okay.
More to suffering.
You know, I have to tell you though, there are 42 chapters until we get to the answer.
Or does suffering make you a better person?
Ah, so we're going to study the book of Job to find out whether suffering through the book makes us a better person. No, I'm kidding. But the role of suffering in the evolution of a human being, I think, is very important. Whether we'll see that in Job, I'm not sure. But we're going to we'll talk around the topic. Hopefully, we'll get to the topic itself. It's funny that no one's mentioned the odd beginning of the book. Right? The whole idea of a conversation between God and, you know, a being identified there as the Satan, some kind of demon or something, we have to talk about what it is for me one of the fascinating reasons for the book, for studying the book, I should say. Joyce has more of the source sheets now. Thank you, Joyce. It's the book of Job. And by the way, I'm going to go back and forth probably all year between calling him Iyov and calling him Job. Iyov being what he is in Hebrew, Job being the standard English spelling of his name. But this book is not unique in Tanakh. There are others who ask this question, whether you're talking about the book of Kohelet, Ecclesiastes, whether you're talking about the prophet Habakkuk, the prophet Jonah asks the question in his own way. It is unique in terms of the length of time devoted to spelling out the question, in the sense that the first 36 chapters of the book are asking the question. So from that perspective, it devotes an awful lot of literary real estate to it. And one of the problems we'll have to get to is, does the book really answer it? Just show of hands, how many people have read through the book of Job at some point? Okay, so we have a range of familiarity with it, but quite a few people have read it. Of those who read it, did you find that it answered the question?
No.
Lots of head shakes.
No.
No. So I happen to think that there are a few reasons for that, including I think we may be asking... The book asks multiple questions, and I'm not sure which of those it's actually trying to answer, and we'll have to see that as we go through it. Because it also asks a separate question, which people miss, I think, in the book, and that is, what motivates people to act righteously, to act in a virtuous way? Because remember, the whole beginning of the book, for those who have seen it, the Satan, this being, turns to God and says, Job really isn't righteous for its own sake. He's righteous because you give him presents. And that's why he's righteous. And I think that's a major theme in the book that sort of gets overlooked, of why do people do good things? So that we're asking a question about why God does what God does, and we're also asking a question of why do people do what they do? So both questions need to be addressed. So having established that we have here in the room somewhere, I don't know, between 20 and 30 people who are interested in studying this book, why doesn't everybody actually study this in depth? And I think the reason is, there are multiple reasons. Number one, it's a long book. There's a lot there. Years and years ago, I started reading it, trying to go through it, and just had to stop at a certain point because it was so dense as a book and there's so much of it there. The language is very challenging in terms of both vocabulary and the sentence structure. It's a challenging book to read. Hebrew familiarity will get you to a certain extent, but even that isn't really sufficient because the book involves not just Hebrew, but heavy doses of Aramaic and influence of other Semitic languages. The speakers in the book are very wordy. Their messages, their metaphors are not entirely clear. The connection between the message of one speaker and the next speaker is not entirely clear. You will have somebody start talking and then somebody else is theoretically responding, and you look at it and say, well, how did that address what he was saying? The commentaries, the classic commentaries, tend to be interested in promoting a particular angle on the book, by and large, rather than translating word for word. So when you read the comments of Ralbag, Gersonides, on it, his primary focus is Greek philosophy and the way that plays into the book, and the book is trying to respond to certain ideas of the Greek philosophers. You read Rashi. Rashi is very interested in Midrash and trying to explain the verses in light of classic rabbinic teaching. So all of this makes the book a hard read. I'm going to try to follow the following path this year. I think we had it in the blurb that Mikko wrote, circulated. What I would like to do is begin, well, this week is going to be introduction, but in general, to start by going through the book, just a straight read of the verses, translations, and what is the substance of each chapter, just to give us a grounding in the book itself. Once we've done that, then I want to go back through and look for themes and explore the way the commentaries have looked at it. Whether this is all accomplished in a year remains to be seen. And that brings me to one last point before we get into the book itself. And that is, this is a challenging book, no question about it, no matter what you do. There's no way to simplify this book. It is what it is. My goal is to try to teach it in a way that, number one, will work for people regardless of their familiarity with text and with Hebrew. And number two, to allow for discussion without being overwhelmed by discussion, which is never easy. So what I would like from you is feedback on the format as we go through this. Meaning, I would very much appreciate if you're finding that either there's too much explanation or not enough explanation, let me know. These are things that can be reasonable, within reason, they can be calibrated. If you want to be able to ask a question or move forward in a conversation and then we move on with the text instead, please email me. I'm always glad to follow up that way, and often that's it's a good way to take a discussion further. Okay. Content of the book. I gave you on your sheets just a basic outline of the structure. Let's take a fast look at it. Because one of the bedeviling, I like that word, bedeviling for this book, aspects of Eov is the way in which you can get lost in terms of just where they are, so to speak, in the process. So the first couple of chapters are the dialogue between God and this being called the Satan, in which the Satan alleges that Job is not truly loyal to him. And then God gives Satan first license to do certain things to Job, and then he gives him more license. And in chapter 3, Job suffers and ultimately comes to curse his own birth. That triggers that's part of, I should say, the arrival of three, call them friends, of Job. By the end, they're not friends. But in the beginning, we'll call them friends. And they each try to initiate a conversation with Job to bring him toward acceptance of that which he is enduring. And so the first one is Eliphaz. And then we get Job's response. And then Bildad, and then Job's response. And then Sofar, and then Job's response. Yes, Farouk.
Questions first for me.
Yeah.
Is Eov Jewish?
No. That's not the first thing, but we will get to it.
Okay.
We will get to this question.
Reading different concepts of a Jewish understanding of what it is.
Yeah. It is. Right. It's a good question. If you want, you can jump to source number 6 and get confused. If not, you can wait till we all get to source number 6 and are confused together. But the answer is not necessarily. And indeed, likely not Jewish. But that's not what makes a book Jewish or not, right? It's the decision of the canonizers of Tanakh to say this book gets in that makes it, for us, a book that we have to contend with from a Jewish point of view. But yeah, we have to see that question. Yes. We're going to talk about that also. Yes. And as a matter of fact, you can look at source number 6 for part of that also. But again, it's a long source. We got time. I wanted to first give us just the structure of it and a little bit about the content. And then after that, talk about the origin of the book of Job. Did Job even exist? Or is this entirely meant as a parable? If you tell his wife he didn't exist, she's going to be upset. The question of when this story was written down, which is separate from the question of when was he supposed to have lived. So I want to get to all those things. We're not going to hit all of them today. We're going to do the best we can. But yes, these are all very important questions for us to see. So you get this first round of debates back and forth. And on the sheet, I tend to use the Hebrew spelling for the names. I hope it will not be too confusing that way. But then you get a second round of debates in which each one of them takes another stab at convincing Job. Job gives his responses. And then you get a third round of debates in which it's just the first two speakers, the first two of these friends, Eliphaz and Bildad. It so far does not appear for reasons that I want to discuss. Then Job restates his case over a course of several chapters. And then we get a fourth person who comes in to speak, who's apparently not from the first friends and may not even have been there the whole time. And that's a fellow named Elihu. And then God suddenly says, okay, I've had enough of this, and I'm going to address Job. He speaks to Job. It is a long and beautiful presentation in which at one point God says, Job, do you have anything to say? And Job says, no, not really. And then at the end, in chapter 42, we get Job's response and then an epilogue in which some of what he has lost is supposedly restored to him. I say supposedly because we have to talk about that and what is restored and what does restoration of one's loss even mean. But all that's still to come. That's just the basic structure of the book so that we understand where things are going. We already mentioned the question that is, for many people, at the core of this book, the question of when bad things happen to good people, how are we supposed to take that? How are we supposed to understand it? And Job spends the bulk of the book saying, all of this is wrong. It is unjust. And either in one read, he says, God has done me an injustice, or in another read, he says, God doesn't run the universe. He says, there's a God, fine. However, the universe is run by the constellations, and astrology is as much responsible as anything else for what happens. It's all by chance. Those are two different ways to take it. Is that a Jewish approach? When Job says it, he doesn't have to be Jewish, but is it a Jewish approach for someone to turn to God and say, as Job does, I want to put you on trial? Right? Long before Chaim Grada and the idea of trying God for the Holocaust, Job says, I want to put God on trial for my suffering. Is that a Jewish approach? Yes, no?
I think it has
been done often.
Can be.
Yes, yes.
It's been done often.
Yes.
I hear no's.
Absolutely.
Absolutely, meaning absolutely yes.
The Jews are allowed to question God.
Yeah.
You
yes.
know, we don't go to hell for questioning God.
I have a hope.
This is more than questioning.
No, but we're allowed to question. In any way, we're allowed to question. That's within, that's part of our membership of us.
Got it. Dahlia?
No, I think that I was always taught that you always have to be respectful and that our purpose in this world is to serve God and that we're always supposed to find what He is trying to get out of us. And it's 100% not the Jewish approach to put God on trial. We can ask God why He's doing this. I mean, I think we learn about how you question God from Abraham's approach to Sodom and finding the right Tzadikim and whether or not he's really going to destroy it. I think that Abraham is the model for how we can question God's
Okay. actions. So, taking the Abraham model, he's polite. He puts it on God to say, well, it will be a disgrace for you to destroy the city, to destroy the wicked and the righteous side by side. But at the end, he loses the argument and he goes home. And he remains loyal to God thereafter. So that's, it's true, it's sort of a limited challenge. Yes?
I say no.
You say no.
I say no because I think it has to do with our limited understanding. And also to using the example of Abraham, at that case there's a huge leap of faith. Right. Gone to the end.
Right, so that's a really interesting point that is worth exploring for a moment. Abraham is full of challenges when it comes to the destruction of Sodom. When God says to him, bring up your son, your only son who you love, Isaac, he says, okay, right? He doesn't challenge at all. Now, one way to look at the difference between those two stories is that in the case of God and Sodom, he actually gives Abraham a reason for why he's destroying Sodom. He says, because Sodom is wicked. And that gives Abraham an opening, because then he can say to God, well, they're not all wicked. Whereas with Isaac, there's no reason given at all. Similarly, after the Jews create the golden calf, and God says, I'm going to destroy them, he turns to Moses, and he says, V'ata hanichali, now leave me alone, and then v'icharapi bahem va'achaleim, then I will be angry at them and I will destroy them. And Moses, as the Talmud explains, says, oh, God said, leave me alone and then I'm going to do it. That means he can't do it as long as I'm bugging him. And so he then pesters God until God says, okay, fine. So there is this sense of sort of needing God to give the nod to him, to permit him to object. Ralph is waiting very patiently.
I think there's a long tradition of challenging God. Baal Shem Tov and all those people who came after him made it a part of their way of life, right, to challenge God. I have a whole book called Arguing with God, which deals with it historically.
Right, that's volume two, you should know, because Job is volume one. it's true, among the Hasidic Rebbes of the last, whatever it is, 250 years, we certainly find that we have the stories, even the songs of them saying, you know, God is responsible for us, God has to forgive, and so on. True, Jean.
I think that when you believe and you observe and you don't question, it isn't the same as questioning, coming to wrong conclusions, and continuing to keep faith. And one is much harder to do than the other, but one has much deeper value. It's like parents who raise children. If God is a loving father and parents love their children, the children don't always understand or accept what the parents choose is right for them. They don't always understand the reasons why.
Right.
But if you ask and you make yourself aware, you have an opportunity to understand and mature into your way of thinking.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. There's growth that comes through the process. That's for sure. I'm going to take Rita and then we'll go further with it.
Saying that the God, that the astrology controls the world, not God, that's not putting God on trial. That's saying to God, you don't control things, there's other things, and that's definitely not Jewish.
Okay. So that's not, it's not trying God, it's judging. It's giving the verdict already.
It's saying that God doesn't have power. We believe God has power. We, by questioning, like Abraham talks to us, we do not believe that, hey, you don't have any power. Astrology, the star, they have the power. I don't think
that's a Jewish. None of these answers are wrong. Judaism is a big place. But we have a range of challenges of God that are presented in Tanakh. Abraham has already been mentioned. The prophet Eliyahu runs away to the wilderness, and God says, what are you doing here? And he says, well, I don't know what else to do because I have been zealous for you and the people are trying to kill all the prophets. They're trying to kill me. God, what are you doing here? How could you allow this to happen? That's a challenge to God. Yirmiyahu, the prophet Jeremiah, challenges God. Yonah, in the book of Jonah, challenges God and says, what is this mercy thing you do? Why are you forgiving people who have committed wrongdoing? If you take a look on your sheet at source number two, a passage out of the Talmud in which a sage, Rabbi Elazar, notes that three of our greatest leaders challenged God, and the phrase he uses for what they did is hitichu devarim klafei mala. Lahatiach is like shooting an arrow. So I translated it as launched, words heavenward. V'amar Rabbi Elazar, chana hiticha devarim klafei mala. Rabbi Elazar says that Chana, the famous Chana, mother of Shmuel, when she was childless, launched words heavenward. Shneamar, as the verse says, Vatit Palel al Hashem. Literally, she prayed on God. Instead of saying El Hashem, that she prayed to God. So he suggests that's an expression of harshness. Praying upon God suggests an attack. It suggests an aggressiveness. Melamed Sheiticha Dvarim Klape Mala, this teaches that she launched words heavenward. Ve'amar Rabbi Elazar, and Rabbi Elazar also said, Eliyahu itiach dvarim klape mala, that Eliyahu launched words at God. Shenamar, and we quote the verse, Va'ata hasibosa et libam achoranit. I'm going to go back and forth between Ashkenaz and Sfarad all year long. I speak to both audiences, and I apologize because I know it's annoying to both, but I end up doing both. But Eliyahu says to God, you have turned their hearts back. God, you are the one who has turned the hearts of the Jews back, who have caused them to be unfaithful to you. And there, Rabbi Shmuel bar Rabbi Yitzchak follows up saying, Minayin shechazar HaKadosh Baruch Hu v'hodalo l'Eliyahu. How do you know that God actually said, you know, you're right? And they quote what God says in the prophet Micha, Dichsiv v'asher harei osi. He says, I'm going to bring back the nation, including Asher Harei Osi, which could be read as those to whom I did bad, but it could also be read, as the Talmud reads it, those who I made ra, those who I made bad. God is taking responsibility for the events in this world that caused people to abandon him. And then third, Va'amar Rabbi Elazar, Moshe hitiach dvarim klape mala, Moshe also launches words heavenward. Shenamar, as the verse says, Vayitpalel Moshe el Hashem. This is after one of the events where the Jews complain about the lack of the things that they want in the wilderness. So Moshe prays to Hashem, to God, Al tikrei el Hashem ela al Hashem. But the Talmud reads it as though, like the word with Hannah, he prayed on God. And it goes further here, and I'm going to say it outside of the text because it's a little bit hard for people to follow it otherwise. In the beginning of the book of Devarim of Deuteronomy, Moshe starts a 5-week-long speech, and it lists a whole bunch of places that where the Jews have been. And one of the places that's listed is called Di Zahav. And the problem is, we don't know of any place where the Jews were that's called Di Zahav. And so the Talmud says, Di Zahav is actually Dai Zahav. Dai in Hebrew means?
Enough.
Enough, exactly. And that what Moshe is saying is that he's saying to God, you want to know why they made a golden calf? Because you gave them so much gold. Because what did you do? You brought them out of Egypt. They marched off to Sinai. You gave them a Torah. You took me away from them. For 6 weeks, they don't have a leader. And they've got all this gold. Well, what are they going to do? They're going to make an idol out of gold so that they have a replacement for me. It's not surprising. And the Talmud goes on further with this. I didn't bring you the entire passage. But Moshe blames God for the sins of the Jews. But I think the best summary of this comes from a passage found in the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud, in source number 3. Just by way of introduction, in case anyone isn't familiar, we know that when the Jews receive the Chumash, when they receive the biblical text, it comes with an explanation. There are just so many verses in the biblical text that you can't understand without an explanation. So these explanations are passed along verbally until you get to a period of about 2,000 years ago, where they found that they were beginning to forget them, and there was a concomitant problem in that the Romans were killing those who were teaching the lessons. And when your lessons are verbal, and they're killing the people who teach it, you have no means of transmitting the Torah, and so they decide to write it down. The first form in which it's written down is called the Mishnah, and that is completed in the beginning of the 3rd century Common Era, and that's mostly law. And then an expansion of it is recorded as what's called Gemara usually. Mishnah and Gemara together make up Talmud, but two versions of the Gemara are recorded. One version is recorded by the sages of the land of Israel living in Tzipori, which is right near Tiberia, near Tiberias. And that's called the Talmud Yerushalmi, Jerusalem Talmud, even though it was never written in Jerusalem. It was written in Tzipori, nonetheless. And then the other edition written later is the Babylonian Talmud. Usually when we just say Talmud, we mean the Babylonian Talmud. But this piece is from the Jerusalem Talmud, and it's very sharp. The prophet Daniel, we learned Daniel 2 years ago in this class, when he addresses God, calls God Hakel HaGadol VeHanora, the powerful, the great, the awesome. This is source number 3 on your sheet. He does not say HaGibor, the mighty, even though the formula going back to Moses was to call God these 4 things. Kel Gadol Gibor Nora, much as it appears in the Amidah today. So he leaves out calling God mighty. Why? as the Talmud explains, Banav Misurin Bekolarin Hechan Higvurato, because when God's children are in chains, where is his might? If God was really mighty, then he would do something about it. Remember, Daniel is saying this while the Jews are in exile in Babylon, suffering under King Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians. They're in poverty, they've been exiled. So he says, I'm sorry, I can't call God Gibor. And the Talmud says, you get to do that? You get to decide which names we're going to use for God? As the Talmud writes it, U'basar v'adam yesh bo koach liten kitzva l'dvarim halalu. Does flesh and blood have the power to make decisions like that? And a very strong line, Amar Rabbi Yitzchak ben Elazar. Rabbi Yitzchak ben Elazar responds, Yod in hein hanevi'im she'elokan amiti ve'inan machani finlo. His prophets know that their God is a God of truth, and therefore he doesn't like flattery. So they're not going to flatter him. They're going to tell it to him straight. And that's what Daniel does in this. Now, the truth of the matter is, you have to take that with a grain of salt, because he still calls God three other terms of praise that connote power. Nonetheless, the message the Talmud is trying to give us, that it's reading into the verse in Daniel, is that, yes, we have a tradition of strong challenge. What Daniel does, omitting a name of God, is not mild. It's not meek. It's a very forward declaration. And remember, finally, the book of Job makes it into Tanakh. Right? The works of Tanakh, traditionally we are taught, are canonized by a group called the Great Assembly in the beginning of the Second Temple. So they're making this decision of what goes in and what goes out. And there were some books that they wanted to exclude. We're taught in the Talmud that Ecclesiastes was almost out of the Talmud. Song of Songs was almost out of the Talmud. Proverbs was almost out of the Talmud. Excuse me, of Tanakh, not the Talmud, of Tanakh. The book of Proverbs was almost out of Tanakh. They made a decision to include Job. Evidently, they felt this is Jewish, or else it wouldn't be here. So I think that's a very important point to remember. One last point on the content, and then we're going to get to the questions of who Job was, when he was supposed to have lived, and so on. But one other point. You look back at the outline that I gave of the content, you see that the first two chapters, and the third, I suppose, also, are story. Then, chapter 42 is story. Everything in between is prose. The other way around. Stories are prose. Everything in between is poetry. And that has led some over the last 150 years to allege that it's actually two different books and it shouldn't be read as one book. That's a very weak argument, though. I know that there is a bias in certain circles towards that kind of argument, but it's a weak argument for reasons that Amos Chacham makes clear in source number 4 from the Da'at Mikra edition of Iyov, of Job. You have it. Excellent. So you can see it on page 9. You don't need to see my retyped version. Take a look at what he has to say in source number 4, because it's important as an introduction to the way we look at the text itself. He says, Sipur HaMa'aseh, which I translated as the narrative, the story part, Eino Nifsak Im Tchilat Tlunat Iyov. It doesn't stop with the start of Iyov's complaint in chapter 3. Ela Nimshach V'Holech V'Chol HaSefer. It continues throughout the book. The narrative story is actually going on in the course of the dialogues. Things are happening. Kol Ma'aneh V'Hama'anehu Chulya. Yeah, it's probably a typo. It should be Kol Ma'aneh V'Ma'u Ma'aneh. But the letter Hey is extra. Kol Ma'aneh U'Ma'anehu Chulya Nosefet V'Sipur HaMa'aseh. He says every single declaration, the ma'anot are the declarations, each one adds a layer to the story. Sipur ha-ma'aseh v'ha-sichot, also called ma'anot, mashlimim zeh etzeh u'tzrichim zeh lazeh. Each piece completes the other and needs the other. Lo navin et divrei ha-sichot im lo nikra tchilat sipur ha-ma'aseh sheberosh ha-sefer. We're not going to understand the conversations unless we read the story in the beginning of the book. The story is what informs everything that happens afterwards. If you try to read the book by taking only the interesting parts, right? So I'm going to read the first couple of chapters and then jump to chapter 42. We will have no clue and we will have not understood the book at all. He says, and even in the beginning and in the end, which we think of as story, there are conversations which affect the way we get the book. The whole thing has to be read as one whole, and the question fundamentally is, then how do the conversations in the course of the book embellish and add to the stories that that bracket them? Okay, so now let's talk about who Eov, who Job is, and the question of when he lived and so on. So first of all, did Job exist? Was there such a being as Job, or is this entirely just, you know, a story that was made up? So if you take a look at source number 5, which the Hebrew is in the bottom of one side, the English is at the top of the other, this is a one-line passage from the Talmud in which we are told, Shlosha yu ba'ata'itza, there were three people involved in that plot. And when it says that plot, what it's talking about is the plot to throw the Jewish baby boys, or maybe all baby boys, it's not so clear, into the river in Egypt. So we are told that there were three people who were part of that plot. Elu Hain, and these are the three. Bilam, Eov, v'Yitro. Bilam, the famous Bilam who would go on to try to curse the Jews. Eov, our hero, or antagonist, we'll have to see, and Yitro, who would become the father-in-law of Moshe. Bilam Sheya'at Neharag. Bilam was the one who actually gave the idea, we're told here, and he was killed. Eov Sheshatak Nidon B'Yisurin. Eov was silent, and he suffered for it. Yitro, who ran away, Shebarach Zachu B'nei Banav, his children had merit, and they went on to teach Torah and become part of the Sanhedrin, and so on. The how we get the association of these three figures with that story in Egypt would have been a great discussion last year when we did an entire year on analyzing Midrash and figuring out where these things come from. But that's not our topic for today. So today I'm just telling it to you not for that purpose, but to show you that we have a voice in the Talmud which is saying Job was part of a story we know about. We have this story we know about that occurs in the Pharaoh's palace with the advisors saying, let's do this to the baby boys, and it makes it sound like we think he's a real person. Yeah?
What would be the source of drawing him into this?
Like I said,
no records.
Like I said, if we had voted to do Midrash again this year, we could do that. But otherwise, it would take a good hour to go through those sources, and we need to get back to Job. It's a very good question, and it is built on verses, just like we saw with all the Midrashim last year. It's just beyond the scope of what we can do. That's nothing, though. Wait till you see source number 6. Here we go. Source number 6 comes from a general passage in the Talmud that talks about the canonization of the books in Tanakh and the question of authorship of each one. So it's building on an initial passage which said, Moshe katav sifro parshat Bilam v'Iyov. Moshe gets credit for writing his book. His book means the Chumash. As well as the passage of Bilam. I'm not going to discuss what the passage of Bilam is. Does this refer to the story that we have in the Torah, but it's being listed separately, or something else? And Eov, Moshe, Moses is the writer of the book of Job. How do you like that? Misayale Rabbi Levi Bar Lachma. And this supports a lesson of Rabbi Levi, son of Lachma, to Amar Rabbi Levi Bar Lachma, because he said the following. Eov bimei Moshe haya. Eov was in the days of Moshe, in the days of Moses. Ksiv hacha, because one text says, in Eov, and I gave you the references in the English for where each verse is found, mi yitain eifo v'yikatvun milai. I wish that my words, that which I'm speaking, I wish that it will be written down. Uchsiv hasam uvame yivada eifo. And Moshe turns to God and says, if you're not going to travel with us in the wilderness because we've sinned, then how will we know that you are in fact supporting us? But Moshe uses the word eifo. Job uses the word eifo. Therefore, they must be associated. Thumbs up or thumbs down? We're seeing thumbs down. It's interesting because that's one of the primary methods used by academic biblical study, is to say, well, this word is unusual and it appears here, this word is unusual and it appears here, therefore the two are associated. So, you know, you should just know who you're putting your thumb down to. It's, you know, the Wellhausen school, so to speak. But but that's what it does here, to which the Talmud says, but what are you talking about? The word a foe is not rare. The word Eifo shows up elsewhere. Ve'ema b'imei Yitzchak. Maybe it was in the days of Isaac, of Yitzchak. Yitzchak, mi Eifo hu hatzad etzayid. After he finds out that after his son Esav comes into the room with a gift of food for him, and he says, well, I just gave the blessing to somebody who brought me food, right? And he says, well, who was the one then who hunted and so on? He uses the word Eifo in his sentence. I guess that means that it was from Yitzchak's time. Ve'ema b'imei Yaakov, maybe it was Yaakov. Dichsiv, in his day, dichsiv, imkein Eifo zos asu. When he tells his kids what to do about bringing food down to Egypt and bring money down to Egypt to get food and so on, he uses the word Eifo. Ve'ema b'imei Yosef, maybe in the days of Joseph, dichsiv Eifo heim ro'im. Yaakov tells Yosef, Jacob tells Joseph, go see where your brothers are, and he uses the word Eifo. The point is not to actually name different eras, because the era of Jacob and the era of Joseph are the same. That's not the point. The point is to say, playing Eifo games isn't gonna cut it. Lo salka da'itach, to which they answer, no, don't think that. It's not that part of the verse that we're picking up on, it's another part of the same verse. Dichsiv, as the verse says, mi yitain ba'sefer v'yuchaku. I wish that my words would be engraved in a book. So what? The word yuchaku is an odd word, to be engraved. Umoshehu di'ikri mechokek, and Moshe is identified as the mechokek. Dichsiv, as the verse says, Vayare shislo kisham chalkas mechokek safun, regarding a portion in the land of Israel being special because the portion of the mechokek was buried there, meaning Moses was buried in a certain part of the land. That made that land special, and Moses is identified as a mechokek. I realize as I'm looking at it that I didn't give you the entire verses, I just gave you the biblical reference. That was in the interest of space. But the point that comes out of this is that the initial attempt, or by Levi Bar Lachma's attempt, to tell us when this book was written down, centers around not the actual events of the book, but around saying, here are certain unique words, let's associate them with other books in Tanakh. Rava disagrees. Rava is another sage. Rav Amar Iyov bimei Meraglim Haya. He says Iyov was from the days of the spies who Moses sent into the land while the Jews were still in the wilderness. That's when Job took place. Ksiv Hacha, because the verse says, Ish Haya be'eretz Utz, Iyov Shmo. That's how the book begins, right? There was a man in the land of Utz, and his name was Job. Uchsiv Hasam, and then there's another verse that says, Hayesh Ba'etz, the spies are charged with seeking out the land, figuring out what things are like there, and Moses says to them, see if there's a tree in the land. So, Utz and Eitz, which is tree. I'm not asking for thumbs on this one, because I know your answer. The Talmud answers it and says, what are you talking about? Midami, hacha Utz Hasam Eitz. How can you compare the two? This is an Utz, it's a land, and this is Eitz, meaning tree. What's the association? To which they give an interesting answer that Moshe actually was saying to the spies, is there that man who lived in Utz, the man of Job, this man Job, is he around? Because he lived as long as a tree, and he protected the generation as a tree. In other words, we weren't doing Utz and Eitz. Rather, it was a medrash associating, I heard him, it was a medrash associating Job with the mission of the spies. Again, I don't want to get bogged down in any one part of this. I'm bringing this here for you, primarily for you to get a sense that it's not only group of us sitting around a table wondering when he lived. The Talmud is struggling with this and trying to figure out, who is this Job? Get another one, and that's going to trigger the debate about whether Job was Jewish or not. Yasiv Ahume Rabbanan Kameid de Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachmeni. One of the sages is sitting in front of Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachmeni. The Yasiv Uka Amar, and he said the following, the student said, Iov lo haya velo nivra. That's a phrase, that's a classic phrase. Lo haya velo nivra means never, ever, ever happened. Okay, literally translated, didn't exist, wasn't created. Lo haya velo nivra, ela mashal haya. It's a parable, it's a lesson. That's it. Stop trying to identify when he lived. So Amar Lei, to which his mentor, Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachmeni, replies and says, you know, Alecha Amar Krat Ish Haya Beretz Utz Iyov Shemo. Well, you know, there's this opening verse in the book, and it says, there was a man in Utz, and his name was Job. So of course he existed. To which the response comes, haven't you ever heard of a parable before? Elameata, don't you know the story? After the incident of King David and Bathsheba, and if there's something we're not getting into as a tangent, that's it. But after that story, the prophet comes to David and rebukes him. And he rebukes him via a story. He says, I want to tell you a story and ask you to judge the people in the story. But he tells him as though it's real. He says to him, there was a poor man who had nothing. All he had was one little lamb that he took care of and that he supported, and the lamb supported him. And he has this wealthy neighbor who makes a feast. And the wealthy neighbor has loads of sheep. And the wealthy neighbor decides that for his feast, he's going to go kill the sheep of the poor neighbor and take that and use it for his feast. And he says to David, how would you judge this man? And David says, off with his head. And he says, you should know, you're the man from that story. But that's clearly a parable, right? That's a parable. It never happened. But he says to him, there was a man, right? You think there was a man means that there actually was somebody who walked on earth and so on. He says to him, as it's recorded here in the Talmud, V'larash ein kol kim kasa achat ktana asher kanav v'yichayeha, that the poor man only had this one lamb that he had bought and that he kept alive. Mihava, was there really someone like that? Ela mashal be'alma, it's a parable. Hakanami mashal be'alma, here too it's a parable. To which Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachmeni says, "Im Kain, if so, Shmo b'Shemi Ro Lama. Then why give us his name? Why give us the name of his city? The fact that there's so much detail means that he did exist." So Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachmeni does not buy the parable argument. We're going to come back to that. But in terms of Farouk's question from before, was he Jewish or not? The answer is neither Jewish nor non-Jewish. He doesn't exist. Do invisible people have a religion? I don't know. Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Elazar, Da Amri Travayu, Iyov Me'ole Golahaya, Ubeit Midrasho Betiveriahaya. Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Elazar say, you know who he was. He was among the Jews who were exiled to Babylon and then came back to the land of Israel afterwards, and he had a study hall in Tiberias. Meaning, the first temple is destroyed by the Babylonians, they exile the Jews to Babylon. He was in that group of Jews from Babylon, and then he came back to the land to the land of Israel. Now, that actually works really well with elements of the book, as we're going to see, the idea that he's from that period of time. But here they grab onto the question of whether he was a Jew or not. By saying that Job was one of those who came out of exile, that means he's Jewish, right? Well, Meitzvei, the Talmud asks, we learned, our first question is that we have a midrash that says that Job's life was from the time the Jews went to Egypt until they came out. A very long time, but that's not even the point. The point is, that's not the time when the Jews are in exile in Babylon. To which they answer, no, he was 210 years old, which is that length of time. Not that he actually lived at that time. Leave aside the question of whether we literally mean he was 210 years old. It's a good question, just not for right now. They're still trying to defend this idea that he's at the time of the Babylonian exile. And that brings us to the next line. Meisve, they challenge and say, we learn the following. Shiv'anivim nisnab ulu umos ha'olam. Seven prophets prophesied for the nations of the world. Ve'eluhain, and here's the list. Bilam is one. The Aviv, Bilam's father, was a prophet as well. How they know that is a separate discussion, but it has to do with the fact that Bilam is always listed as Bilam ben Beor, the son of Beor. We associate the father and son and say they were in the same trade of prophecy. The Iyov, and there's Job on the list. And then the rest of the list are the four other speakers from our book. Eliphaz, Bildad, Zophar, and Elihu are all on the list. So the point is, Job is listed as a prophet for the nations of the world. So how can you tell me he's a Jew who came out of exile in Babylon if he is a prophet for the nations? To which the Talmud says, well, that doesn't bother me. V'litameich, within your view, Elihu ben Barachel lav mi Yisrael hava. What about Elihu, who's on that list? wasn't he in fact a Jew? How do I know that he is a that he's a Jew? Aktiv mimishpachat Ram. The text, when it introduces him, says he's from the Ram family, which was not just a famous printing family in Jewish publishing in the 19th century, but biblically there's a family known as Ram. They're mentioned at the end of the book of Ruth as part of the line that would produce King David. So Elihu is Jewish. Ella invuye invi l'umos ha'olam. Hachanami Iov invuye invi l'umos ha'olam. He says you can be a Jew, and still prophesy for the nations of the world. We know that, right? Who in Tanakh was Jewish and prophesied for the nations?
Yonah,
right? Who else? There are more. Ovadia has a message that's for the nations. Amos has a message that's for the nations as well. There's another one named Moshe, right, who carries messages to the nations. It's not as though you have to be only for the Jews. And that's the next line. Atu kulu nevi milo invoy l'umos ha'olam. Why are you even asking this question? Didn't all the prophets say things that had to do with the nations of the world? To which they answer, yes, but then they usually focus mostly on the Jews, like Moshe. Here, their central one is for the nation. So that proof is sort of hedged. Like, you can read it one way, you can read it another way. Not clear whether Job is meant to be not Jewish or meant to be Jewish. Next line. Meisve, they challenge and say, we have an explicit rabbinic teaching, which says, Chasid haya b'umos ha'olam v'iyo shemo. There was a pious person among the nations of the world, and his name was Job. And then it continues to speak more about him. I want to come back to that line at another point, but I don't want to lose our thread here, so I'm going to skip the rest of the line. But here you have an explicit Talmudic source saying that Job is not Jewish. So they answer, if you're following in the Hebrew, Tana'ihi, if you're following in the English, where it says this question, whether Iob was Jewish, is the subject of a debate of the Mishnaic sages. This, in fact, is a very old debate. And just because I don't want people to fall asleep, I'm going to sum up the next several lines. But you have Rabbi Elazar saying Job was around in the time of the judges, the period between Joshua and King Saul. You have Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha say he's at the time of the Purim story, the days of Achashverosh. Rabbi Natan says that Iob was in the days of the kingdom of Sheba. The sages say Iob was in the time of the Chaldeans, making him very early. There's reason to make that association from the language of the text as well. And then some say that he's actually in the days of Yaakov, in the days of Jacob, and that he married Dinah, daughter of Yaakov, and so on. What do you draw from all of this? Yeah. That's what you draw from this. Hang on.
If he's Jewish.
Well, it matters a great deal whether he's Jewish or not, for reasons I'll come back to in just a moment. But the it's very clear we don't know. We have a whole range of views, which some of them stem from looking at the language of the book. Some of them stem from separate rabbinic teachings. Some of them stem from events that occur within the book, like the line about the Chaldeans. It's not at all clear, and everyone is struggling with this question. So Ralph says, who cares? Does it really matter? Just read the book already. But the answer is, I think it does matter. Because I'm painting him, me, the book is painting him, as a righteous person. And he is going to say things which we've already identified as very harsh challenges to God and make declarations like God doesn't run the show and so on. And so I want to know, does somebody described as a tzaddik and a Jew, can he get away with saying things like that and still be called righteous, which he does through the end of the book? He does get called righteous. I'm not blowing the ending. So I want to know, can this book put this in the mouth of somebody it considers to be Jewish? That to me is why this question is significant, and why, in fact, you have a debate among the sages as to whether he's a Jew or not. So I think that point is significant. Aside from the question which we started with of does he actually exist? Now we only have a couple of minutes left, so I want to make sure to show you source number 7. Source number 7 is from Maimonides' work, Guide of the Perplexed. He has a whole chapter that's just on Job, and we'll be referring to it, I hope, in the course of the year. But he begins by saying, Inyan Iyov Hanifla, Humikat Mashanachnu Bo. He says the incredible matter of Job, of Iyov, is of the type that we've been discussing, that he's discussed in the chapters previous to this one. Rotelomar, meaning, Shehu Mashal, it is a parable. Leva'er de'ot b'nei adam b'hashkacha. It's meant to lay out the range of human views regarding divine supervision of the world. Umamar k'tzatam Iyov lo haya v'lo nivra ela mashal haya. And that's how some said in the Talmud, we read it, that he's a parable. V'asher chashvu shahaya v'nivra v'shehu inyan she'ira lo yadu lo zman v'lo makom. He says, look, those who think he actually existed couldn't pick a time and couldn't pick a place and say, this definitively is where he was. And we'll have to talk about what Utz was and where Utz may have been, and we're not going to have a clear answer on that either. And that strengthens the perspective of Iyov never existed. Now, I have to tell you, hold on one second, I have to tell you that that's not the last word because of source number 8, but we're not going to see source number 8 today. There is a third possibility. Possibility number 1, Iyov never existed. Possibility number 2, Iyov existed at some point in time and this is his story. But possibility number 3 is that somebody named Iyov existed and was known to them. And the writer of this book said, I'm going to link this story to this known historical person for reasons that we would then have to discuss. But that's what we're going to see in source number 8. There very likely is somebody known to the Jews by the name of Iyov, whether this story happens with him or not. Question back there.
Kind of partially.
Yeah.
Because if we decide or agree to that it is a parable,
yeah,
it has a lot of significant importance regardless if he existed or not, and so who created the story?
Right. And that's
so we kind of.
Right. And that's part of what I want to get to, although it's not going to be today, obviously, at this point. But I'm just going to take Kitty's question. But yes, that's part of that's the next question to ask.
Maybe with all the places we think, all the times we think he was in, you know, for Moses and this one and that one, maybe there's a little piece of all those times in Job.
That's brilliant.
Know, all these pieces of times and people in one person.
Mm-hmm. I like it because it fits. In other words, when you look at the sale of Joseph, one of the cases that we mentioned, and you think of good people suffering, or you look at the Jews in the time of the Purim story and so on, these are all times when that question is begged, no more so perhaps than for Yaakov, who is the iconic good person who suffers. The guy can't catch a break. All through his life, he suffers. If he's not running away from his brother, he's suffering from his kids. So I definitely hear the idea that putting it in those times is meant to make a statement about the relevance of the book for those periods. Thank you. I like that idea. Just to summarize very quickly, we talked a lot about the book itself as a fascinating book and the question of, you know, why people learn it or why people would not learn it. We laid out the basic structure of the book, mm-hmm. talked about the right to revolt, and established that we do have a tradition of challenging and even harshly challenging God. Whether we get to give the verdict and say, okay, God isn't in control or not is a good question. And then we saw this range of Talmudic views as to whether he existed and if he existed, when he existed, and the conclusion of Maimonides that he's a parable and should not be read as anything more. We still need to see the verses in Yechezkel and Ezekiel that I listed for you in source number 8. And God willing, we'll talk about that next time. We'll talk about the ramifications of calling it a parable. And then move to the question of when the story is supposed to have taken place. A little bit more about whether he's Jewish or not. When was the story written down? And then we have two choices, which I'm going to put to you to think about and probably send them out by email. I had thought that perhaps as part of the introduction to the book, we could go through a little bit of discussion of the range of classic views on when bad things happen to good people, just to see that there is, in fact, a range of classic views and to take one class on it, not to spend a lot of time. On the other hand, we're here to study text of the book of Job, and that means pushing off another week, getting to actual text. So what I would like to do, and I'll send it out by email, God willing, so I do hope your email addresses are with Joyce. If they're not yet, please see her after. But I want to send out the question there and see what people want and go based on what the majority are looking for in terms of whether we spend a week on that or not. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And,